Blog
okay, we're on.
Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Justine Rotolo, also known as Miss ADD. I want to welcome everyone to the program today. And before I bring Chris on, and we're going to talk about meditation and mindfulness and how it can really help control the executive function deficits of ADHD, I'm going to just remind everybody who's in the Los Angeles area about two adult support groups that I run for CHAD, Children and Adults with ADD. And the first one is in Torrance, California. It's on Wednesday nights from 7:30 to 9, and it's located at the Center for Learning Unlimited. That's a school dedicated to ADHD and autism children, 2785 Pacific Coast Highway. It's a wonderful group. It's been going for 5 years now. We've got a lot of growth going on in that group, a lot of love, a lot of acceptance, just really good people in that group. And the same thing is for my other group, which I just started the last week in June, and that's in Culver City, California. Again, close to Los Angeles, and for everybody who's in that area, that's going to be Thursday nights now, and that's going to be earlier, 6 to 7:30, and the location is 6666 Green Valley Circle. It's the Share building. The Share building is actually a building that is a pretty amazing place, a lot of 12-step programs going on, and it can feel the love in that building. It's just pretty incredible, the energy. And that group as well, a lot of wonderful people, a lot of people that just really want to get better, trying to work hard to get better. So those are the two groups that I run in the Los Angeles area. So without further ado, I'm going to invite Chris on the phone. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Justine.
How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. And how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Fabulous.
So we're going to spend some time today talking about meditation and mindfulness. And one of the things that I've noticed, and I don't know if you have lately, is there have been some people that have said to me, you know, it's very difficult for me having ADHD and being able to sit still and meditate or sit still and be mindful. And what I've been trying to let them know is you don't have to sit still. I mean, there's walking meditation and there's exercise meditation and swimming meditation and driving. I meditate when I drive because I have to. You have to be in the moment in Los Angeles or,
right,
you know, you get killed. So you want to talk a little bit about that? Because you have ADHD as well as I do.
So going back to my own experience prior to being diagnosed some years back, I was trying to get into mindfulness. I knew I was, my mind was bouncing from thing to thing, but I didn't know it was ADHD. Big H, capital H. So when I was trying to sit and meditate, I would sit there for a couple of minutes and off I went, you know, and then shiny red ball, there I go, squirrel, there I go. And I tried over and over and over and over again. And I actually had contacted a friend, father of a friend who was a Buddhist monk. And he said, you know, this is what you need to do and, you know, just keep at it. And I kept at it and kept at it. And I just felt like I was banging my head against the wall. So, you know, starting into the therapy, you know, the medication, the, you know, taking those kinds of steps that we'll probably talk about later to be in the moment enabled me to get to that point and to be mindful about being mindful, to stop and to be able to just let things be for a little while. So it's very hard. I have friends that are, I guess, diagnosed ADHD. I have others who believe they are ADHD and who exhibit the signs and symptoms, but for whatever reason have chosen not to pursue a formal diagnosis.
Okay.
Which, working in the government, that could be detrimental, you know, it could be, or you just say it is what it is and you move on, but that's their choice. But I find that in discussions with them, we all struggle with that. Stopping, being in the moment, and unless you're really applying yourself. And it's something you have to be deliberate about.
So what I'm hearing you say, and I think this is really important information for people who are listening, is medication, not meditation, but medication actually helped you?
Oh, my God. It was a critical first step because it was the part that it was like step one in the process of going, well, step two. Step one is I have a problem. And then, okay, it's ADHD. Okay, great. All right, step two was the medication. The medication, the way I put it is I tell people it lit off the front of my brain. The executive functioning where I could, I remember the very first day, I will probably never, ever forget it. The very first day I took my first Vyvanse pill, which is the medication I've been taking, there was a calm that came over me that I had never, ever experienced before. And I went, wow, this is what it's like. Holy crap, I've been missing this my entire life. At the time, it was a fairly high dose, and the doctor, since we've played around with it and got it dialed in, but I guess you'd say that, yes, that was that critical first step. That was the piece that enabled me to stop for a moment to go, okay, maybe I can meditate. And it didn't come overnight. It was still a process, but
right.
Medication was definitely key to that.
So did you also, have you noticed over the 4 years, okay, that you've been working through this, taking this journey?
Right.
Because it's a continued journey.
Yes.
Have you also noticed that with mindfulness and meditation that you've been able to lower your medication a little bit?
No. And so
okay.
In your case, and you know, I was really excited to hear, wow, you came off your meds, and
right.
it gave me a goal. So in reality, what's happened is my medication has almost doubled. And by that, I mean, when the doctor first started me, I was at almost the top end of the medication. And
70?
75.
Okay.
70? Yeah, it was 70. 70, right.
That's the highest of Vyvanse, yeah.
So it came back down, and I think I was down to as low as 20, and it just, like, it wasn't there. So what happened is I went up to 30, and I stayed there for a while, but what was happening is I get up early in the morning. I'm at work 7, 8 o'clock. Try to be there at 7 every day. So I would take the pill so that by the time I'm getting to work, I'm present for that. Well, by noon, 1 o'clock, literally, the medication had worn out. Type A, so my metabolism just was eating through it. And I went back to my doctor, explained, and what he did was he effectively doubled the dose. So I was taking 2 30s a day. And that lasted for a while, and I was doing that for a while, and I hit a particularly rough period that just seemed to consume. Well, earlier this year, I 6 months of going through just very challenging times, and every bit of energy was being used to get through that 6 months, and my dosage up during that time to 40 twice a day. But I find myself in a place. And I was just sharing with you before we came on about how I'm able to be mindful when something hits my stuff and I'm angry or frustrated or whatever. I'm there, but within a fairly short period of time, I was able to step out of that, look at my own behavior, and then go back and apologize, in this case, to family members.
So this is really interesting. I think this is something I want people who are listening to understand, because I have a lot of people out there who do not believe that this works, that this can really help the symptoms, the executive function deficits of ADHD. But the other thing it can do, mindfulness meditation, can help us to deal with our past. So one of the things, because Chris and I are writing a workbook together, and that workbook, we've given ourselves a deadline to be done with it December 1st. That doesn't mean it's going to be out and published December 1st, but we're going to be done, because this is what you do when you're ADHD. You set a date for something to be done so you're not playing with this for 4 years. We're excited, so excited about this workbook, because these are the steps that I use to get better, that Chris has used, that other people in my group and private clients have used, and I'm going to finally put it down on paper, and Chris is helping to do this process as well, because his input is valuable. And one of the things that he and I kind of disagreed about initially, my first step for me was self-awareness. And part of that was because I was in the middle of extreme trauma, and I needed to get well quickly. And so people were saying things to me about myself, like, you're controlling, you're very negative. My kids would tell me about the tone in my voice. So I was able to listen because I was in a place where I really wanted to get better. But for most people, Chris pointed out to me, and he's absolutely right, the mindfulness comes first. And can you explain why you say that?
Well, the mindfulness is, for me, and this is why, you know, I had brought this up with you, was, okay, so going back to 2 months, I think, when we talked last time, I talked about a story that I'd shared about, if everybody agrees there's an asshole in the room and you can't identify that person, it's you. Well, being aware to identify that that person is in the room is the first step. So looking around and just not just at myself, but just looking around to go, okay, what's happening in my life for real now?
Right.
And is, I guess it's common knowledge now, divorced and kind of moving on and things like that. But it was coming to terms with what my life really was, not necessarily who I was yet. This is where I'm at. I'm going to these meetings on Wednesday night. I'm going to mediation with my wife, or soon-to-be ex-wife at the time. I'm trying to keep my relationship with my son and my job and all these other things, but I had not yet hit a point at which I had begun to turn that awareness inward. And that took a little while, and it wasn't until things got really bad that I went, okay, I really have to start asking myself, why are these things happening? And I, as a result of that, found that I was bringing, or I was the cause of that, that was it. But that's that self-awareness to go, here's my behaviors. And as you know, I've been in therapy for a long time. I have a therapist up in Ventura, Dr. Laura Forsythe, and she was very careful about maneuvering me into helping me to find out these things about myself, because some of them were pretty brutal. But I think step by step, if you open up and you ask yourself fairly easy questions like, do you find yourself withholding information from others? If the answer is yes, yeah, you might be controlling, you know, and all these other things. So once I started really looking at my behavior like that, then I started really looking inward. But I couldn't do that. I couldn't take that inward look until I had the wherewithal to stop and actually look. I was just literally being lived.
Because when you first started showing up to group, mm-hmm. right, you had contacted me, told me you were in Ventura. And for those of you who are listening around the country, that's about a 2-hour drive down to Torrance, correct?
It's about an hour and 15-minute drive on no traffic. But in Los Angeles, and especially on a weeknight, it was at times 3 hours.
Right, okay.
So really bad nights. But it was about 2.5 hours on average there.
Right. So I was really, really excited to think that Chris really wanted to get well that much to sit in L.A. traffic. If any of you have experienced, you know what I'm talking about. It's brutal. It's the largest parking lot in the world, the 405, and it's 6 lanes in one direction. So you can just imagine what that was like for him to drive down. And when you first came, you were very nice, you were very friendly, but there was an edge to you, kind of like you were looking at me sideways, kind of saying,
"Oh, you can call it what it is." I came in there, you know, really just looking for answers. And I'd looked at some of the other programs that were up near where I was at, and they weren't offering anything. And what I looked at, what you had, seemed very close to what I needed. But I didn't come in a good way. I was not on my best behavior, putting it mildly.
I thought it was fun. You know, because you were a challenge, and I love challenges, and especially somebody who's controlling, since I spent most of my life in situations like that, which, you know, wasn't pleasant, but I learned how to deal with it. But I think that as the group began to grow, as the structure in the group began to grow, because I recognized that we didn't have enough structure in the group, then you began to grow as well and began to see things about yourself that I was trying to point out as kindly as possible. We would joke around, but I was really seeing that you were in a lot of pain.
Yeah, and thinking about it, because I did have that break for, really have to go back and look, but it was maybe close to a year. You know, I was going to the meetings very regularly, and then I stopped going, and I think that was a point at which I was starting to really, you were pointing things out, and I was seeing them, and I was still in denial.
Right.
And it was hard, and, you know, it's a credit to you that instead of, you know, saying, hey, you know, you're an ass, and just putting it on the table, you kind of walk me through this, you know, like you said, you had the training and the wherewithal to go, okay, well, I've dealt with people like this before, and it was kind of a process of opening my eyes and going, oh, and the more I went to the meetings, the more I was finding out about myself, and I think a lot of us were, identifying, you know, who we really are or who we, how we were behaving.
So, and I also think it's important to point out something too, because I think a lot of people tend to do this. So, you know, you go to a group or you go to therapy and you start to feel a little bit better. You start to feel a little bit better. You know, you may be a little bit more focused. You may be a little bit more emotionally regulated. You know, these are the executive function deficits. Maybe you're a little less impulsive, okay? Maybe you're not procrastinating the way you used to. So you say, oh, I got this. That's one of my favorite. I love this because it's one of my favorite things, especially with teenagers when they come in and they go, I got this. And I go, really? Okay, what are you doing here? You got this, you know? But it's the way I was, too, when I was younger and even, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. I got this. I don't need anybody's help.
Oh, yeah.
And then if we're really honest with ourselves, we really, with the mindfulness, the little bit of mindfulness that we've picked up and meditation, we begin going inward.
Right.
And we really start that advanced mindfulness part of really looking at the stuff, the psyche, the ego, what all this was built upon from our childhood.
In the advanced mindfulness, which I for the longest time, and you've talked about it, I guess, you've talked about it for a while. It just kind of galvanized as you were just now talking, and I went, okay, the way you put that was, because I did the same thing. I started feeling a little better. This is easy stuff. I got it, and you leave. Problem is that you've never felt good before, so feeling just 2% better than you did when you walked in the door, you think you're better. You still got 98% of goodness left to find. Leave out the door without all the tools necessary. That advanced mindfulness is now fully present, knowing that I'm not dealing with people anymore. I'm dealing with their egos. I'm dealing with my own ego interacting with other people's egos, which is incident earlier today was two egos that went clashing, and I needed to step back out of it and say, okay, well, so one of us has got to be an adult. So I guess I've had spent all the money in therapy. I guess it should be me.
But I think what happened today, too, is that your stuff from years ago got hit.
Decades ago.
Decades.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, but in the process of it getting hit, in the past, what happened by you, you know, losing your temper, okay?
Right.
It would have stayed that way.
Oh, yeah.
But with this work that you've been doing on yourself, you walked away from the situation for about 20 minutes because you had to go get your phone that you left at the supermarket.
Oh, my gosh.
Talk about being in the moment. And you found it, which was perfect.
Yep.
And when you went back, you said, hey, you know what? I'm not going to spend my life saying I'm right and everybody else is wrong. You got healthy and said, I'm going to apologize because losing your temper is just not acceptable. It's right. Not an adult way to behave.
It's not. And I again, going back to the ego, the advanced mindfulness you talk about, your ego is constantly inflating itself, working itself. It's very hard to do that when you're sitting in front of somebody going, okay, this is what happened. This is why, you know, how my stuff got hit. This is why I behaved the way I did, and I'm sorry. Deflates the ego completely.
Right.
And to defend myself with the phone part, yes, you know, a couple weeks ago you
here
left
we
your
go.
ATM machine or your card in the ATM machine. Let me throw it out there for anybody who hadn't heard that. She walked away from the machine with her card in there. I did the same thing, very much like you had done. I went home, had my stuff hit. Now I'm dealing with this issue with, you know, let's call it what it is. It was with a family member. And I'm looking around for my phone, and it's not there. I didn't get wrapped around the axle about it. I went, okay, well, let me just go to this store. And so I went to the store, and as I'm driving there, I was thinking about why did I react the way I did? Because up to that point, I was having a great time. You know, the past 24 hours has been wonderful. So what changed? The first thought is what did they do? You know, what changed? And it was inside. Start looking inside and realize, you know, as you say, my stuff got hit.
Right.
And then I get there, and I'm thinking, well, if my phone's not here, what's my next plan? Not, oh, crap, my life's over. So and when the guy said, yeah, it's right here, I was, oh, wonderful. Let me go back and start making apologies now,
right,
because I was wrong.
Right. And so to talk for a minute about what I did,
mm-hmm,
right, because I don't think I've talked on air, but for the most part, I'm pretty good with knowing where stuff is. But this particular day, and this is exactly what everybody goes through with stress. And when we get stressed in this population, that's why mindfulness is so powerful. All the work that we've done on ourselves in terms of staying in the moment can kind of go out the window. And this particular day, my younger son...
Momentarily, though, I think. It's not that it goes out the window.
No, momentarily.
It's put on pause momentarily.
Right. And my younger son, who was home, was having some medical issues. And I was concerned because I didn't know what was happening. And he was in the car with me, and I stopped to get some cash, which I don't do. I never go to the ATM machine. It's something I just don't do. And I put the card in. So by the time I got where I was going, and I was looking for my card to pay for something, it's just like you, instead of getting upset, I retraced my steps. I gave myself compassion.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of mindfulness.
Oh,
being able to say, okay, I made a mistake, I'm a human being, I'm entitled to this mistake, and I'm going to learn from this. Went back to the bank, and actually, the woman in the bank reprimanded me. So that was just great, because what was going on in my head was, excuse me, do I work for you, or you work for what has this
well,
work?
Kudos for you for not choking her.
I didn't say a word. I just said, you're right, you're absolutely right, I should have paid more attention, but I didn't, give me the card, let me go. But I was very kind. Didn't really want to be, but I was. And I learned from that. I really did learn from, again, slowing down even more when I'm in a stressful situation. When there are things going on that are causing me stress, I need to really focus a little bit more about being in the moment so I'm not losing things. But, yeah, it did happen to me, too.
Well, so you learn from it, and in sharing that, I learn from it. And in throwing you under the bus and putting it out on the air now, you know, everybody else can learn from our own mistakes. But I think the other thing, and it just clicked the common theme between the two, we're family members. Our family can hit our junk quicker than anybody else. And these, in my case, was my mom. My mom can push my button and get me 0 to 60 faster than anybody else.
Right.
But I know that now. I'm aware of that. And through the discussions that you and I have had, I can think about that. It was why I went to the truck and started thinking, okay, what happened?
Right.
Not okay, I'm going to be angry. And in the past, go back 5 years, I'd have left. Said, I've had enough of this crap. I'm out of here. Gone.
Right.
As opposed to, well, let me go to the store, get my phone, and figure out why this, you know, why a perfectly good, you know, weekend thus far had turned south, and how to recover it so that it doesn't all have to be wasted. And it wasn't.
Right.
And went back, said my piece, spent another, you know, 45 minutes or so kind of going over that, and then put it behind and move on, enjoy the rest of the time. And I think, honestly, the reason I left my phone, I was thinking about being here today. So I get to come out here, I get to talk, and I enjoy doing this. I enjoy talking with you. So.
And, no, I enjoy having you on the show because it's really powerful shows when we do them together, which I think is really great. But, you know, getting back for a moment to what you figured out today, I think in our population, I think you've witnessed this in both groups. There's a lot of pushback sometimes with, this is my fault. I lost my temper. And a lot of that stems from how we grew up. I mean, you know, my name was Lazy Stupid Procrastinator. And that was from the time I was little.
Couldn't be. That was my name.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to take it from you. But, you know, back in the Stone Age, they didn't know anything about ADHD.
Right.
You know, we were just considered lazy and we weren't doing our work and, you know, we weren't handing stuff in and we weren't doing well in school. So that kind of stays with you.
Mm-hmm.
Those words kind of stay with you and they can turn you into an extremely negative individual, which is exactly what happened to me. So if anybody ever wanted me to take responsibility for something that I did, oh, no, that wasn't going to happen because I didn't do that. Because I was in protection mode,
right,
most of my life.
And that's it. We're almost programmed to be in that defensive mode so that the first reaction for anything anymore is whenever you're being attacked is not to go, okay, let's look at the issue. It's no, let's go on defense. And oftentimes the best defense is a good offense.
Exactly.
Which unfortunately is the... It's the worst possible thing you can do. So 100% with what you're saying in that stop, look at the situation, but we don't do that. We're not programmed that way. And it is a deprogramming of decades of behavior.
Right.
And that's why people don't want to do that.
No, because it takes a lot of work. And the work that you've done, the work I've done, the work that a lot of the other people in the groups are doing.
Right.
Takes time.
Mm-hmm.
This takes time. And I want everybody to understand that. I've been doing this for 5 years, and I still left my card in the machine. But my point is, had I not started this process, then I wouldn't be at the point where I am emotionally regulated. I don't go up as easily as I used to before. In fact, I don't go up. I'm pretty regulated.
Mm-hmm.
Even when the woman hit me in the bank, what she was saying to me was, you're a bad girl. Back to my childhood.
Oh, yeah.
You're a bad girl. You made a mistake. You look what you did. You left your card. So if I really wasn't in tune with my own schemas, which is a whole nother thing that we do, where would I be?
Right.
I'd be yelling at her, giving her my stuff.
Right. Instead of sitting there going, looking at her through a different set of eyes now, going with now compassion, going, wow, I wonder what happened in her life that she feels compelled to yell at me for losing my card, which has absolutely no bearing on her life whatsoever. She
right.
knows nothing of me,
right.
but yet she feels compelled to yell at me.
Right.
There's something wrong with that picture, and then looking at it through that perspective, that's where that realization that, okay, now I'm dealing with egos now. It's not people, because it's not rational behavior.
Well, listen, and my ego was telling me that day, because this is the advanced mindfulness thing, because if you listen, your ego talks to you. That's the voice inside your head.
Mm-hmm.
My ego was saying, what the hell happened to you? I thought you were from New York. You're not going to rip this person's face off?
Right.
And I'm like, no, I'm not engaging here with you at this moment. I'm not going to go there.
Right.
I'm just in the moment. And I'm feeling for the day that this woman has had. She probably didn't have a good day. And in doing that, I'm not being weak. In doing that, my life is easier.
That's tremendous strength to keep from allowing your ego to take her ego on. I mean, how many people have the wherewithal to do that? They
right.
jump in there and just go at it.
Right, exactly. And that's why this whole mindful thing can be so powerful if you're willing to do the work. So what are the steps involved in just starting out with the mindfulness, right? Well, it's what we did one of the first nights that I think you were there, where we brought in a flower.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody got their own flower. And we were, for 3 minutes, we focused on the flower. And we kept bringing our thoughts back to just examining the petals on the flower, the stem, all different things about the flower, so that our thoughts were in that moment. They mm-hmm. weren't drifting off.
Right.
And that's one of the exercises.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, because for the ADD mind, traditional Buddhist meditation, and I'm now attending a Monday night group, it is literally, focus on your breathing and try and push everything else out of your mind. That's impossible for the ADD mind.
Right.
So having that flower to then focus the energy on and to then take it apart, and as you say, we have vivid imagination. So to look at that and then to just look at the different aspects of it and to really get into it is so helpful. And it begins to train the mind to not jump from thing to thing to thing, but to be with the flower. And when you start thinking about where the flower was raised at, no, I'm looking at the flower. Where is it going to be displayed at? No, I'm looking at the flower.
Right.
That is difficult, as simple as it sounds. It's not, and it takes time. And, doing it continually enabled me to be with that flower and then to be without that flower and just be for a while.
Right.
And it's still struggle with it, and that's why I go to group every Monday night. It's that continual reminder. I'm sitting with other people that are being present and
right.
quiet and
right.
there.
Right, and I think once you experience, and I know that you have felt this many times, but I remember vividly experiencing for the first time the moment, being in the moment. Wow, there was so much peace in that moment. And that's why if you allow yourself to experience that, why you crave it. Because our lives can be so chaotic at times
mm-hmm.
because of the way our minds work. And we could be going like a Ferrari
mm-hmm.
all day long. There's no peace in that. There's just constant going. We're
right.
going. We're going. Our mind's going here. Then it's going there. Then it's going somewhere else. And we're constantly trying to catch up. Whereas in the moment, when you're in the moment, there's so much peace and harmony. It's so amazing.
That's where we're to be found, I think, in the moment, in my ethereal way of putting it. But jumping to thing to thing to thing, we're avoiding what we don't want to deal with, which is who we are. But when we can stop and really look at who we are, and it goes back to what we talked about, the self-awareness and looking at our own behaviors, positive or negative, and dealing with those one at a time, and that for me took a while, and I'm still going through it. But I can't honestly say that I remember when I felt that awareness. I remember the time frame at which it occurred, and at the time I was working, this is some time back, I was working, I worked for Department of the Navy, and I was working on one of the more war going on and all this nonsense, and I was working on a system that was very stressful. And to be in the middle of all of that and not a tied up ball of stress, and to just look at things and go, okay, I can deal with them one at a time. And back then I wasn't where I'm at now, where I can stay out of that. So at some point I'd get sucked back into the madness. So it was a process of doing that. But over the course of time, the time gets a little shorter and a little shorter. Between the time that my stuff gets hit and the time I can pull myself out and just be
right.
be there. So, and then just be to the next place and to the next place. And that's the other reason why I think I go to meditation is it's a skill that's got to be honed some.
It's like a muscle.
Yeah, yeah.
That you've got to keep working, lifting,
right.
whatever you do to help increase that muscle.
Because I stopped for a while, and we talked about that, and I was not, and things weren't working out so good. So,
yeah.
Okay, well, what can I do to change that? So you're right, it's something that's got to be exercised. I wasn't exercising it, so my pool of available resources started drying up. And before it's completely gone, needed to refill it. So going, you know, refills that pot.
So, okay, first we did the flower to get everybody to understand what it would feel like to be in the moment, to be able to focus on the moment and not engage in the thoughts that come up, right? Okay. And then, I don't know if you were there, I think you were, when we went out and bought 30 balloons.
Nope, missed that one, but you told me about it.
So this is something, and I encourage people to do this. You don't have to buy 30, but what my husband and I did was went out and bought these 30 balloons, and we had people hold on to these balloons through the group. So for an hour and a half, we were passing around these balloons, and each person would sit there and hold them. And each time they were passed, I would remind the person that had them, those are your thoughts. And actually, Steve is funny because what he did was he got all different kinds of balloons. It's a boy, it's a girl, happy birthday. So all different things on the balloons represented the thoughts.
Right.
So I would say to people, okay, now right here while you're sitting there with these in your hand, it's not as intrusive as, but think about this. Take them into the shower with you, all 30 balloons. Put them in the car and drive to work. They're going to be all over the car, driving you crazy. Take them into a meeting, even getting them through the door at work. So I just wanted everybody to know what these thoughts are doing to them. They're bogging them down.
Oh, yeah.
And this is why, for anybody who's listening, if you want to use this as an exercise, it's a powerful exercise. Because what you're really finding out is how these thoughts are affecting you every single day. I mean, they're just making your day just absolutely horrific. And then at the end of group, we'd all go outside and I would release the balloons up into the sky so that everybody could watch them just kind of go. And that's where I want everybody to be, watching their thoughts, not engaging, just saying, wow, that's a fascinating thought, but I'm not engaging in that one. There's another one that's fascinating, but I'm not engaging in that one. Because when we get these thoughts out of our head, what happens? We get focused.
Right. You're not drugged down. My analogy is being drugged down to the tunnels and these dark places that our thoughts often take us. And it starts innocently enough. You know, it's a boy, happy birthday. Wow, the thing at work didn't work out so good. Your son's not calling you. And, you know, the next thing you're putting yourself down, and it's a slippery slope to sitting in a dark place.
Right.
So being able to thin those thoughts out and identify, ooh, there's a thought I don't think I want to play with terribly much. So letting it pass by. And being on its own is very helpful.
Right. And we talked about this a little bit on Thursday night. We went back to, I don't know if I've said this on the air, but I gave an example of a thought process. So I'm driving home and my mind says, oh, Jacine, you have to get milk. That's a pretty easy thought, right? Okay, so I have to go to the store, I have to go to Ralph's or, you know, Albertson's, and I have to get milk, or to 7-Eleven, wherever I decide to go. But then the mind starts talking. Oh, do you have money for milk? Oh, wait a minute. Do you have enough money for rent? Oh, my God. You're going to end up under the 405 with my dog Enzo on a rope. You know, that's where the mind takes you.
Oh, yeah.
That incredible spiral where, before you know it, your body's shaken. You can't even function anymore. How are you ever supposed to focus?
And that's one of the downsides to our creativity is it'll creatively put us under the 405. It finds these ways to really, I think, take us down. So, but it's very true that it happens, and it happens very quickly.
Yes. Yeah, and I think a lot of people agree. When I talk to them about this, and I use that example of just that little bit of the milk, it can really take you down that path of no return.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and because you have chosen, and this is the part that I need people to understand, you made the choice to engage in that thought. That's
a hard thing, though. I mean, for most of us, and I'm still battling that. I really do see it and understand it. But at the same time, when you're thinking a certain way for so long, it becomes is. This is the way it is. But with a certain level of mindfulness, it comes to, no, I am making that decision because I can choose to think something else, and our feelings are so strong. Having the wherewithal to just stop,
pause, that pause button. Do you know what somebody actually did in group? They drew a pause button on the bottom of their hand.
That's pretty smart.
This is very smart.
Yeah.
And they're going to press it every time their mind starts talking to them to take that pause to say, I don't need to engage in this.
Well, there's tools available on iPhones, and I was listening to something on the radio the other day about an application that does this, but really you can do it with any timer. Every 30 minutes, just a simple alarm goes off. In my case, I have, it's not a gong, it's a bell.
I love it.
That the Buddhists use. It's low tone, but it goes off every 30 minutes, and it's that, if you're down, in some rat hole someplace, working some project that really is not where you need to be, it's that reminder for me to go, hey, where am I at? What am I doing? Looking at my board going, ooh, I still got this other project due today. Why don't I step out of this and into that? And that can be taken into your personal life to find yourself, am I in the third hour of sitting down watching television? Oh, maybe I ought to stop doing that.
Right.
And go find something else.
Right. Or am I in the third hour of this thought spiral?
Oh, yeah.
That I've got absolutely nothing done. This is why I'm procrastinating. So that bell goes off,
mm-hmm.
or the pause button is looked at,
mm-hmm.
and it's like, okay, I'm not doing this anymore. And look, I'm not being insensitive because you know that a couple of weeks ago I was struggling with things with my older son, who
right.
is an alcoholic. And when I get into that process, it is very difficult for me to let go of that spiral because this is my son. But I now have a sponsor in Al-Anon, and I'm going to start working the steps. So I'm hoping that that's going to be my pause button every time I start thinking or he tries to engage me in a certain way, that I can just kind of step away and say, you know what? I'm not going to choose to engage in that thought process.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go on with my day. Because as a coach, as a therapist, I have clients all day long. So I have to be in the moment. Because if I'm not, they're going to know that.
Right.
When they're trying to talk to me and I'm trying to do mindful listening and my mind is bouncing off the walls because of things that are going on in my life.
Right.
So it is possible, even, at the most difficult areas in your life where your children are concerned or, maybe your husband's having an affair or your wife is mm-hmm. having an affair and you're spinning all over the place because you want to make sure that you can control this or fix this. And really, in the moment, you can't do anything about that.
Well, look at your own journey. And like you said at the beginning of the program, you're in your fifth year doing this. Had you've been struggling with the things that you're now encountering, with your sons, oh my God, there would have been right off the edge of the cliff.
Right.
Because, and even now, 5 years into this, I know you're struggling with it, and I know that you're really invested in this, but it's starting off with the small things. It's starting off with those things that they hit us and they irritate us a little bit, and being mindful of, okay, well, why is it when I'm going to work and I hit every red light, it irritates me. Well, it's because I'm cutting things short. I have a 30-minute drive. I leave 30 minutes before I have to be there, and any little thing that goes wrong is going to make me late.
Exactly.
Well, if I leave 45 minutes, am I still going to be upset when I hit every red light? No. Okay, why don't I do that? And then you get used to not being upset when you hit a red light or every red light or being caught up in traffic or things like that.
Right.
First couple of months, first couple of years coming down to LA, it was stressful. The traffic is what it is, and I would be concerned I'm going to miss the meeting or I'm going to be late. And now I'm still coming. I come to Culver City, and God bless, it's an hour less off my drive time. But even if I am running late, I don't get wired up about it. It's, I'm going to be late. I pull over, give you a call, say, hey, I'm going to be a little late to the meeting, shoot you a text, whatever. I'm on my way.
Right.
And then just let that go, that fear, that concern. And but it starting with the small things, because the things that I was dealing with earlier this year, had they hit me 5 years ago, I don't really know. God only knows how I would have reacted to that. I don't think I could have handled it.
No.
But there was a lot of, I say smaller things, but there were still things that were painful, that were uncomfortable, that were, you know, all of the above. But working through them one at a time, don't go trying to tackle the divorce. Don't go trying to tackle the cheating husband or wife or those really difficult situations with children. It wasn't an intentional decision. It just happened to be how it played out for me.
And I believe that loving kindness, as you know, because you're doing the Buddhism, that's where it comes from. It's called meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we give ourselves and we give others that are in our lives, whether these are people that we love or these are people that we really don't like. We do meditation depending on where we're at,
mm-hmm.
on this loving kindness. You know, I give love to everybody. I give love to myself, but to yourself is first and foremost. That's part of the whole mindfulness, is that compassion I talked about before.
Right.
The other piece of that that's really big is that lack of judgment. So we can't judge our thoughts as they come up. If you think about it, if you don't judge a thought, you can't engage in it. Just like noticing it. That's
mm-hmm.
a fascinating thought. That's really fascinating. But I can't even engage in that right now because I have other things I have to do. So I'm not going to judge it. Maybe I'll give it some compassion, you know. So judging thoughts, judging yourself, which is a big one that we do all the time.
Right.
Judging others.
Well, going back to your schemas and being, I think, mindful or very aware of them, at least those critical ones, and I have a couple of key ones that for me, so like, you know, 15 of them, well, probably now, I haven't gone back and revisited the list, but I would say at least half, let's just say half don't apply. Well, no worries there. All right, of those remaining 9, probably 7 are of, you know, small consequence, but there's a couple in there, like earlier today, they get hit, and being mindful that those two schemas, those two areas are risky.
Right.
And that when those get pulled into the situation, when those thoughts come up, we're vulnerable to them.
Yes.
And I'm more aware of that now. There are certain things, areas of my life that I know when one of those gets hit, I've got to step out of the situation, be it rude, be it whatever it's considered, I need to leave, because there's no way I can control my behavior in the middle of it.
So bringing that up is powerful, because schema work with couples can be very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have couples that I see, and what I notice is that many times, you know, one couple will have, one of the male may have a group of schemas that the female doesn't, but she may have other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For those of you who do not know what schemas are, they're a collection of thoughts that develop during childhood, early adolescence, or early adulthood. They can also develop as we get older. We can create our own schemas related to situations that can protect us.
Right.
Right? Because that's what we're all about, is protection. And I see that when those schemas come up, when couples tend to hit each other's schemas, that's when things can really get bad.
Right.
If you're not understanding what's happening.
And that's where the egos become extremely dangerous, because after a while, you understand what the other person's buttons are, and this is the language that's used. You know how to push somebody else's buttons, and they know how to push yours. Well, it literally, your internal mechanisms know what their schemas are and how to hit them, and hard, and which ones are the most threatening. You know, for me, those two schemas that I have that are my weak areas, it could be construed a weakness of mine if other people knew it, because they could, you know, intentionally go after them. Well, that's fine, go after them, but I'm already aware of what they are.
Right.
And I know that when they get hit, I need to get in the car and go to the grocery store
right.
and go get my phone or,
right.
or whatever, go take my dog for a walk, whatever the case is, because it's a threat to me and I have to step back. So, and that's interesting about the couples, though. I mean, going back, so many things that I know now, had I known 10 years ago, I'm pretty sure things would have turned out differently, but they turned out the way they did because that's the way they were intended to turn out.
Exactly.
So
I think that one of the things I just want to mention to everybody who's listening is that for me in this work I did, if you want to call it advanced mindfulness, schema therapy, getting my stuff hit, emotional individuation is another term that I use that I've done podcasts on before. When I recognize now that one of my schemas is being hit, I'm okay because I've done the work and I've been released it already.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this week something happened to me that one of my most – okay, so here's my biggest schema for me, okay? It's not listed in the book, so to speak. But for me – getting blamed for something I didn't do, okay, that stems from my childhood. So when that happens to me now, I can feel that energy just stop. Because what we're talking about, for everybody who's listening, when you're mindful, when you're in the moment, your energy flow is high. This has nothing to do with food. And it has nothing to do with exercise.
Right.
It has everything to do with the internal energy. That if you keep running this energy through your body, you get, something comes up, you run it through your heart. It doesn't get caught in your head. Chapter 11,
right?
Paying the Price of Freedom, your favorite chapter in The Untethered Soul. So as this whole process is working, then we're beginning to feel, wow, I can do this. There's no fear. Because I know what this is.
Mm-hmm.
I know when this comes up for me, when somebody blames me for doing something that I didn't do, I don't have to start screaming and yelling and throwing things around because I've dealt with this already. I know what this is. So it's very easy for me to say, okay, I can deal with this. I can have a conversation with this person on a completely different level. It's not about screaming.
Right. So going back a couple of years, one of my, and it's not a schema, it's money. Money was one of those areas for me that when growing up, grew up poor. So when I finally hit a point in my life when I had money, I always made sure I had money. And I knew one guy probably 15 years ago. He carried like $300 cash in his wallet at all times. He never left the house unless he had at least that. And I thought, well, that's kind of excessive, but okay. He liked his wallet thick or whatever, but that was his fear. Mine was I had to have so much money in my checking account so that I knew, you know, mortgage payment had to be made. It could be made or whatever happened, there was that I was protected. So... And when I was getting divorced, as divorces often do, it revolves around finances and the money's going here and there and this and that. And the cost of mediation totaled $14,000 eventually. And so that was draining away at our resources and some other things. And I remember just the feeling that energy just sucked the life out of me.
Yeah.
And it was eventually later on becoming aware that that's a fear and then learning how to cope with that fear. And that's a whole nother discussion for another time. But facing that fear head on to the point where, you know, if I got 29 bucks in the checking account, I got 29 bucks, you know, and if it goes into a negative, it doesn't affect very much. You know, there's going to be a couple of bills I got or fees I have to pay and, you know, it's a hit to the credit. But at the end, losing, you know, shutting down, and that's what would happen before. Shutting down is not the right answer because then nothing else gets done.
No, so, and here's something else, too, to ask you this question. So I use this as an example, and it's very similar to your checking account, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if there's $29 in your checking account,
mm-hmm.
whether you're calm and in the moment or all stressed out and missing the moment and everything else, is that going to change the $29 in your account?
Well, actually, yeah, because in the case of I'm stressed out and not in the moment, I end up making mistakes that could, an example, and this happened to me during the course of the divorce, there was a, I have one auto deduction that comes out every month. It's $67 for an insurance policy. I lost the ball on that. I wasn't paying attention, and my checking account started getting very low. And instead of going, being mindful of the fact that, oh, by the way, now I'm going to have this thing hitting, I'm freaking out because of other things. And I could have reacted to it and shifted a little bit of money from savings over and taken care of the problem, but I didn't. The auto deduction hit, it took it into a negative. And then, you know, so that's the next step. So, yeah, being mindful, the $29, so, and I guess in that respect, the $29 is there. That's what it is.
Right.
Being mindful enables you to keep from making it worse.
Right. Right. And so another example I use is, you know, you've got a flight at LAX, my
mm-hmm.
favorite place in the world, right? And you leave just a little bit later than what you needed to leave. So you're in the car. For me, I'm on PCH, and I'm just banging the steering wheel and screaming at everybody because they're in my way, and I've got a flight. So is that going to change the outcome of whether or not I'm going to make that flight? It's really not. But if I was calm and I was in the moment and I was just acceptance and awareness,
right,
then when I get to the airport, the same outcome, only this time I'm calm.
Oh, and better yet, when you get to the airport, you arrive. So if you arrive in instance number one, you're just a ball of stress. You get to the checkout, you know, and the person behind the counter can feel that stress.
Absolutely.
And they react accordingly. And I think oftentimes the wall goes up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in a pinch. I need something. All they hear is I need something and give me, give me, give me. As opposed to the second instance where, okay, this is what it is. I'm going to get to the airport when I get there. And now you arrive at the counter and you're in a different place. Your energy gives off a different vibe. And you just get there and you say, this is what, this is where I'm at. How can you help me?
Right.
And the reaction is completely different in that. In the second instance, oftentimes people react in a far more positive way because they don't feel that they're being threatened in
right.
the process.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
So, and that's why I use that example, because I really think it's important for everybody to know that we all have choices
mm-hmm.
on first of all, when we go out the door.
Right.
I mean, you know, we can either, as you said before, I have a 30-minute drive to work. Well, you can either leave 45 minutes ahead of time, so you've got time to play with. You can get yourself a cup of coffee before you go to your desk, and wow, what a great way to start the morning. And by the way, for parents who are listening, the same thing goes when your children are going out the door to school. The worst way for a child with ADHD or any child to start their morning is feeling stressed, feeling negative stuff coming at them.
Mm-hmm.
So do everything you can in the morning. Make sure their backpack is at the door the night before. They've picked out their clothes the night before. You know, they've taken a shower. Their lunch is made and in the refrigerator, so it goes into the backpack as well. All these things we do ahead of time so our children can walk out the door in the morning feeling happy
mm-hmm.
and not feeling all stressed out. What a terrible way to start the day.
Oh, yeah, and it just it carries on for the rest of the day.
It's horrible. It's horrible for adults, and I really believe it's worse. It's absolutely worse for kids.
Well,
you
because
know?
Is there the brain's developing, that's the norm. That becomes the norm. I need to leave out of the house stressed out, worried, and preoccupied with things that are of no relevance to life, as opposed to stepping out of the door and, you know, looking at the day going, okay, what's going to happen today? What are going to be the great things that are going to happen today? And using that, you know, energy just to be like driving. This is such a good, you talked about meditation earlier. I'm really bad. There's two places that my mind just goes ape, even still. You put me in the shower, and I'm thinking about everything in the world. I'm creating, or I'm saving the world, you know, and solving world hunger in there. And when I'm driving, because there's so much stimulus hitting you, or it's wherever I'm going. You know, what am I doing? What am I going to be faced with? And then I'm looking at, you know, the cars ahead, cars behind,
right,
the environment. So those are pretty, I won't say dangerous places, but for me, they're things I need to be cautious of, that I go in there and then I come out, or I get to work and I'm already five layers deep into garbage, as opposed to going to get that cup of coffee, sitting down, okay,
yeah,
what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And but to drive and to just think about that cup of coffee, think about that time, think about what it is that you want, not what it is you're afraid of.
Exactly.
So, and that makes a big difference oftentimes. And, it, you know, it's the difference between a great start of a day or worst case scenario, you get to work and your boss is already lit off with, you know, things that are going wrong. You want to arrive already in a bad mood? It's just going to get worse from there.
Exactly.
As opposed to being mindful and having the wherewithal to go, okay, so how do we tackle this?
Right, because what you were just saying, too, about having those positive thoughts. Wow, I'm getting out of the door this morning 45 minutes early, which means I don't have to race to red lights or race through yellow lights,
mm-hmm,
chance of getting a ticket. I can focus on that hot cup of coffee that I'm going to get to have at my desk in a peaceful way.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I know that you're very organized in this way, but there's a lot of people in this population that are not. But before you leave the office at night, you really need to clean your desk off, because coming in to work the next morning, it's really good to come to a clean desk because it helps a lot.
Oh, yeah. It makes a big difference, especially because we're so prone to being caught. I heard somebody talking, this was in the last 2 days, about leaving things out, and how it was one of the previous podcasts, how I think it was Alan, and he talked about leaving, being careful about leaving things in piles, and in such a way that I was thinking about that, going, for me, I don't want to come in and see anything on my desk. When I come in, there should be the stapler and the computer,
right,
and that's it.
Right.
Because if I leave something on my desk, that then becomes the priority, as opposed to, and that's, I used to work that way, and ADHD people, you, and I've got a number of friends, I go look at their desks, and oh my God, their file cabinets are literally on their desks, and their file cabinets are empty, because they keep the things out that they want to see to be triggers, as opposed to being mindful enough to write down on the board, here's the things I need to do, selecting between them, not moving piles on the desk around. And I used to do that, but it's a horrible way to live, because then you're losing things in the piles. Get rid of what you don't need, keep what I do need, and then, you know, tomorrow morning when I arrive, I'm arriving to my stapler and my computer.
So I have to tell you that I had a kid today. He's amazing. He's a sophomore in high school. And one of his biggest issues is procrastination. And he made an analogy,
mm-hmm,
today, which I thought was pretty brilliant. He says that every summer they visit this lake. I guess it's up somewhere north of here, 5 hours north of here near Napa, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a cliff that they jump off, land in the lake,
mm-hmm,
right? And he said, and as I'm heading towards that cliff, there's a part of me that wants to stop from jumping off the cliff.
Right.
But I kind of talk myself into it, and then I jump off, and when I hit the water, I go, wow, this is just great. This is wonderful. And he compared this to procrastination, because what he was saying is that a lot of the things that he has to do cause fear. And that's absolutely true. When we procrastinate, there may be something that is causing us fear. So what he's been trying to do, because we've been working together,
mm-hmm,
is he's been trying to just push through that fear, like jumping off the cliff.
Right.
And he says that when he pushes through that fear and starts doing the work, he recognizes that it isn't so hard. Now, here we go again, ladies and gentlemen. This is a teenager. Okay? This is what I love about teenagers. They are not committed to their poor me story, their negative story. They want to get better.
Right.
And that's what I love about teenagers, because they don't have all the baggage. So if you get them when they're young and you really start to work, bring them to a coach so they can start working on all these executive function deficits, they really want to get better. They want to do better.
Another thing a teenager has, or rather doesn't have, that many of us adults do, is this fear of saying, I don't know.
Exactly.
And even today, I still have that fear of going, okay, I'm sitting in a situation, I've got to do this, not quite sure how to proceed, which means I now have to go ask somebody, what am I going to do?
Right.
And it's the same thing, that fear comes up that, oh, I don't want to do this, really.
Right.
Because then they're going to look at me as being incompetent and da-da-da-da. But eventually, you overcome, do I want to be looked at as incompetent or being competent?
But what you just said is about baggage. See.
Yeah, it's fear.
It's fear. And so a lot of teenagers, some of them really don't want to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the things I work with a lot of them as well. But for the most part, their fear is not as deep.
Mm-mm.
Because they don't have that baggage. So what I tell people that have piles on their desk, and I know you've heard me say this, is there's fear in those piles. So pull out the fear, get a fear folder, put the fear in that folder, mark it fear, and go through the rest of the stuff. Either, throw it out, or what's the other thing that we do? Shred it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, whatever you have to do, or file it. Put it away so you know where it is. Then I ask my clients to bring their fear folder in. Let's go through it together. You know, years ago, I used this as an example. I had medical bills that were piling up. Why? Because I didn't know how to fill out the paperwork to submit the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, I asked one of my coworkers, hey, can you show me how to do this? And they were like, this is the easiest thing in the world. Let me sit down with you. And after that, I never had a problem. All my bills were submitted on time.
Mm-hmm.
It's because I was afraid of the process, and I didn't even know what the process was.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that's a lot of where we get stuck.
So you'd talked about the fear folder some time back. You'd shared that with me. And I don't remember if this came before or after as a result of that discussion, but I have a folder. It's made by a company called Levenger. And I don't know if they make it anymore because I got it close to a decade ago when I was living in Michigan. But it essentially holds 3x5 cards, and it's made for executives. Well, I work for an executive, and he bought one. I said, hey, that looks pretty cool. And I got one, and I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. And it's very simple. It holds 3x5 cards. It's the most rudimentary thing in the world in my mind. But the reality is that if you write down what your fear is, I've got a couple of projects that are those, for me, those are the life and death projects at work. Those are the things that keep the bread and butter or keep me getting paid. So those are written down on those 3x5 cards, and they're that constant reminder. And every once and again, I'll have something critical come up, and I can put a post-it on that to go, here's that critical thing that I need to do. And the way the folder's set up, I can prop it open and set it on my desk on the edge. So it's standing up. I'm looking at it. On each side holds 9 cards, 3x5 cards. You only see the top half of it, but that's plenty enough room to write with a Sharpie what that project or what that other thing is. The right side I use for personal things. Right now there's some changes going on in my life, which I've shared with you, Justine. And here are the things that I need to accomplish, and if they don't happen, it's going to create a ripple effect. So
right.
I've got to have this and this and this done. Those things get written over there. But those fears, I think, need to, until we figure a way to just compartmentalize them in our head, and I'm not there yet, obviously, they still have to be written down somewhere.
Right.
That folder every day gets folded, And I generally take it home, though I don't do anything with it at the house. I always tend to keep the cards filled out at work. Even for my home stuff, just seeing it is enough that when I get home, I know I've got to work on this and this today.
Right.
I get to work the next day. I open it up. Okay, the email, nothing major is going on there. What's the next biggest? What's his name? Brian Tracy, an author who I've read a couple of times, wrote a book called something to do with eating a frog. And
I think I've heard it.
Yeah.
I think I've heard of this book.
Oh, it bothers me that I can't, because I've read a couple. I've read it a couple of times, but he said if you're gonna eat two frogs, you eat the biggest, hairiest, ugliest looking frog first.
Right.
For me, it's those are the big, hairy, ugly frogs that are sitting on those 3x5 cards. They're the fears that I'm confronted with, looking at, going, ugh. And they're oftentimes, you know, with the teenager, those are the things that I procrastinate with. But it's kind of hard to do that when you're staring at it. So
right.
Confront it face on. It's beautiful.
Well, I tell people I work with that when you're going to prioritize
mm-hmm.
to do something, put the most difficult thing first.
Mm-hmm.
It's like eating the hairy frog. Because if you get that done, then the rest of the stuff is easier.
Right.
Whereas if you do the easy stuff first, by the time you get to the hard thing, it's like, I can't do this today.
Oh, yeah, it'll be there tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. And we just keep pushing it off for the next day, the next day, the next day. So the next thing I wanted to talk about, because this is something that Lydia Zylowska, who wrote the ADHD prescription for mindfulness, the mindfulness prescription for adult ADHD. I said it backwards, which I do a lot. She talks about, which I have talked about a lot with my clients and in group, polarized thinking, okay, which is actually cognitive distortions.
Mm.
And I think a lot of us deal in absolutes and in extremes. And the polarized thinking really is about extremes. That's extreme thinking, okay?
Yeah.
So she has a couple of these, and they're called mind traps. And I really love these, you know. It's all or nothing thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So how many times have you ever said never or always?
Yeah.
Right.
You know what? That's one of the things that when I – and this has been more as of late than any – I find that I use them a lot more than I wish I did.
Right.
And I catch myself going, well, it's really not that. It's not. You know, it's really not that.
No.
You know, even though I say it really is, really isn't, it's very this, very that. Stepping back from that, you're right. Oh, yeah.
And see, and that's why she says, in addition to judgmental thinking, some thoughts are a sort of mind trap.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's all centered around not being mindful, okay, because they get you stuck.
Right.
With ADHD, these mind traps often come from thinking that is polarized, where things are extreme in either positive or negative direction. And we are very, very black and white, okay? For years, I went to therapy, okay? Years, and I didn't get it because it was too gray
mm-hmm.
for me to understand until I finally then began to understand the concepts and grab them because I was able to do it after going for such a long time.
Right.
Because our minds are... For the most part, we're black and white. That's how we think. With mindfulness, you can notice when such thinking, also known as I just said, cognitive distortions, arise and then choose to rebalance. So if we're in a situation where we see yourself and others or situation as all good or all bad or seeing only one way of doing something, for example, I have to be right all the time. To me, that's the ruination of society, okay? I have to get all of this done today or I will never get it done. This all sucks. This will never end, and so forth. Words like never or always are cues that this kind of thinking has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So when we hear these words, we know to rebalance. That's what she's saying. And I think it's brilliant because I talk about cognitive distortions with clients all the time. And we talk about extremes and polarized thinking and going to one extreme or the other extreme. And I get up every day, and one of my mantras every single morning is, okay, today I'm going to do my best to live in the middle. I'm going to live in the Tao. That's what they call it in Buddhism,
yep.
is the Tao, is
right.
in the middle. So that's one. Then blaming others or blaming yourself. That's another extreme.
Mm-hmm.
It's either your fault or I'm sorry, this is all my fault. I mean, I know a lot of people with ADHD that tend to take on everything that happens like it's all theirs. It's not anybody else. Well, when you have a relationship with somebody, unless it's the king of narcissism, it's impossible to think that everything in that relationship is your fault. When you're in a relationship, it's 100-100. It's not even 50-50. You know, are there situations where people are alcoholics or drug addicts or, you know, they're domestic abusers and they hit or, yeah, there are. But for the most part, you can't be taking responsibility for everything in the relationship.
And you just hit a good point about it's 100-100 on both sides. I can say in my own case that brought up to think that a relationship is 50-50. So I have to put in my 50% and they have to put in their 50. Guess what? There's still 50% missing. It's going to fail. The reality is the relationship is two individuals.
Yep.
And those individuals are responsible to themselves first and then to the relationship second.
Yep.
And to say, okay, stepping out of the relationship, am I responsible for this? No, I didn't agree to this. So why should I feel bad that this didn't get done? We've never communicated about it. There might have been an expectation, but it wasn't verbalized.
Right.
So you go back and we say, hey, this didn't happen. Next time, one of the other of us, you negotiate to a way out of it for next time. But you're right.
It's 100-100.
It is.
But that's adults.
Right.
See, and when there isn't a child, you know, I have a lot of couples that I see where, you know, the one without ADHD will say to me, I have four children, and I only have three. He or she's the fourth.
Right.
Because they've never grown up.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of very immature behavior.
Definitely. I. This is one of those areas that I've been struggling with for a while, but the reality is, and it was a discussion with Reese that really, for me, made it real. And she shared about growing up. We had a short discussion, but it was very meaningful in that I'd come to really recognize that in myself, I was still, and this was fairly recently, I was still immature in certain areas. And then I go back and think about, oh my gosh, my wife was putting up with that. And I remember she had to go in the grocery store with my son and I because we were just off the chart. Riding the carts, you know, just being obnoxious, and which is kind of odd because you take me 12 hours later, I'd be in my uniform going to work, and I was Mr. Johnny on spot. So, but in many ways, she was dealing with a child,
right.
another child,
right.
and that's a hard thing to really accept. That's another level of, I guess, self-awareness that I had to come to terms with. But yeah, that is, and I wasn't all that. I wasn't communicating to her everything. I think there was that expectation of, she ought to know this. You know, she's mom. You know, she's the wife. I didn't communicate my wants, needs. And it is 50-50 in the context that we've got to throw our words in there and to put that together, to say it, to make that whole. But we have to stand as individuals independent of one another. And I wasn't doing that in our relationship.
You talk about not communicating to her. You weren't communicating to yourself. So it's impossible for you to communicate to her. See, that's the first step.
And that's true.
Yeah.
Very much true.
And that's all part of the self-awareness process is, hey, because I was a kid in my marriage to my second husband
mm-hmm.
and my first husband, you know, as well. I was very much a kid, putting all my feelings and my emotions onto them. And, you know, you take care of this and, you know, I'll go do this, and I wasn't responsible with money. So, yeah, no, I was a disaster, and I take full responsibility for that. In this marriage, I'm very much an adult. I'm on top of all finances. I know what we can do and what we can't do, and I take responsibility for my own emotions. I hold on to them. I don't give them to Steve and say, here you go, take care of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I could have never done that if I wasn't first aware of being aware of what's going on inside me.
Right.
You know, and that's part of what people miss.
Well, the other piece is to be healed enough to accept that.
Right.
Because oftentimes, you talked earlier about there's a lot of baggage, a lot of junk, just a lot of stuff that we carry with us all these years, and that trunk continually gets bigger. And to confront something that's very painful, like, wow, I am being immature, that's hard. It's very hard. And I still at times don't think I'm fully cognizant or being fully honest about it, but I'm far more so than I ever was in the past. So, and it's becoming easier to go to see what it is.
Well, you know, that whole thing of growing up is not an easy process, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things we're going to do together in the workbook, right? We're doing all these things, and we're going to help people with all this. But, you know, I really believe that in that process, we are learning every single moment more about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But remember this, we grow developmentally till the day we die.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people think that because I've done all this work and I've been doing this for 5 years that I'm done. No, there's no way I'm done. This is one of the reasons I love running these groups, because every week I grow more and more. Every day I grow. And at those groups, I'm really able to let my hair down and talk about losing my card at the bank, or, you know, talk about losing my mind over other things that are happening in my life that I have to pull back and come to center. I'm not perfect. There's no such thing as perfect.
Right.
I make mistakes every day. The difference is years ago I couldn't get past those mistakes. Now I give myself compassion every time I make a mistake.
That growth, I found, is it can be separated. So there's a part, and I believe you had told me this the first time, and it's been since reinforced through other areas, different people, is that a point at which a person is traumatized as a child, their growth stops, and that energy then becomes used for defense. It's a self-defense mechanism, and I had numerous traumas growing up as a child, so I emotionally stopped growing as an adolescent. But there's the other part of growth, and I think a lot of that took place for me through coming to your group, through doing a lot of things that I did. I was growing and becoming more in tune and in touch with things, but emotionally, still a train wreck. That was the discussion I had with Reese that opened the door to how do I get to that child and how do I resolve that.
And that's going to happen for everybody in the workbook.
It's huge. It's huge because I'm having heard her say it and then, you know, just going through these steps and getting to that point of understanding, it's wonderful because I think the personal growth at that point, because emotionally I'm still kind of held back, but once that opens the door, it Lord only knows where it's going to go.
Which is what I did to grow up, is that piece with the child.
Right.
Same piece that Reese did, because we did that, her and I, together.
Mm-hmm.
And she's done incredible work and is just so amazing. She was on the show a couple of weeks ago with me,
mm-hmm.
and she's just really done the work, like you're doing the work. And once you do the work, then you get to that place where you're able to really individuate.
Well, going back to mindfulness, and especially about being self-aware, what worked for you, I found it wasn't working for me.
Right.
And Reese put a different angle on it. And when I heard her say it, and not necessarily what she did, but her take on it, I kind of realized, okay, I'm now a third person in this equation. Mine's going to be different, and
yes,
I've taken a different approach to it.
Yes.
So being mindful that I'm not you two, and that, okay, here's the process, here's what I got to do, but it's not going to look like this, you know, kind of stepping back from that and going, what, how do I accomplish that through my own means and ways?
And you will, because what you said is true. Just because it worked for me the way I did this work, I think a lot of how we're going to lay this out for people is really going to be amazing,
mm-hmm.
because it is the steps to getting better, right? But in each step, everybody may do them a little differently.
Right.
Everybody maybe may tweak it just a little differently so that it works for them, and
right.
they get to that better place where they need to be, so that they become the adult that they need to be.
In the last
emotionally.
Time I was here talking with you, I said one of my steps, which I don't think anybody else in your group has taken, is sitting on the highway for 2.5 hours every Wednesday. That was an important
right.
step for me. So here's some examples of steps that other people have used. I think incorporating those kinds of things and then, you know, leaving space for what do you think would be your steps? What do you think would speak to you emotionally, speak to you
right.
that part of you that
needs right.
to be spoken to?
And what I love about this population is they're so creative.
Oh, yeah.
That when we come out with the book and we start asking them those kind of questions, we're really going to get a lot of different answers.
Without a doubt.
You know, in being a group, that somebody has an issue and we throw the issue out on the table, and, you know, 20 people are telling them things to do. Do
mm-hmm.
this. Try this. It's an incredible population. So just quickly, I want to finish up these polarized or cognitive distortions. And so there's magnifying or minimizing, you know, blowing something out of proportion or making it so slow. The other one is making assumptions or not seeing the obvious. And the last one is rigid rule-based thinking versus lack of rules. So I want to thank Lydia, because I did go up to her seminar in Petaluma, and she's an amazing human being.
Mm-hmm.
And she's in private practice up there, if anybody's interested, and lives up there. Lydia Zylowska, she's a psychiatrist, and she deals specifically with ADHD. She's amazing and does a lot of mindfulness and meditation. And I think her book is an incredible book. For those of you who don't have it, again, The Mindfulness Prescription for Adult ADHD. There's a lot of powerful information in this book. I cannot believe that done here, because it's 5:27. We've almost gone through 90 minutes. And every time you're on, it's like this. I want to thank you. And I know you're going to be on more and more as we get closer to, you know, introducing this book, and we're going to have some CDs that's going to go along with it. And I'm really excited about this, because we're going to help a lot of people. And
me too.
I want everybody just to remember, you know, we're giving you a few steps here for mindfulness and meditation, but, you know, there's a thing out there called the meditation movie. For those of you who haven't seen it, and I'm not sure that you did, because you weren't a group when I showed it.
Mm-mm.
It's online. It's free. I would suggest you watch the movie. It's a powerful interpretation of what mindfulness can do for anybody with ADHD. It's amazing. And also meditation. You know, there's all different kinds of meditation. You can do walking meditation, running meditation, swimming. You don't have to sit still and meditate, you know. And if the breathing is an issue for you, because for me in the beginning it was, I do the let it be, you know. Thoughts come up, let it be.
Right.
I mean, so that's, you know, something that I want everybody to just really start to work on. Mindfulness meditation, it's a big prescription for ADHD. And Lydia and Dr. Dan Siegel and Dr. Ziggy Hale from UCLA have done, you know, a lot of studies on this. So it does, it works. But you have to work it.
Right.
That's the most important
thing.
Yeah. So anything else you want to share in the next 6 seconds that we have left?
No, other than to say thank you for bringing me back on. It's always a pleasure to be here. And
it's great having
speaking
you.
And talking with you.
Yeah.
And I, too, am excited about this in that I've gone through this. I'm living it. And I, knowing where I came from, where I'm going, and to be able to share that with other people is, oh, my God, exciting. It really is, because 40 years of just not so good.
We're going to have a lot of fun doing this. We
yeah.
really are, because I know that both of us have the same passion of helping people get better. And that is something that is the most important thing to me. It's one of the reasons I do these groups every week, because I just love sharing my story and helping people get better and feel good about themselves and grow up and be adults with their kids and in their marriages. So I want to tell everybody who's listening to thank you for tuning in. Chris and I want to say goodbye, and we will be here. I will be here next week. I'm not yet sure exactly what the show's going to be, but we always post it on Facebook. So I want everybody to have a great night. And remember, please, to always stay in the moment.